Hey, Women Rulers, this is Anna Palmer, your host. Thanks so much for listening. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate us and leave a review. It's the best way for other listeners to find us. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at apalmerdc. And now, here's this week's show.
The news broke with Roger Ailes first. By the time the news broke with Bill O'Reilly, and it had progressed to the point where women in the building were talking about it daily. I mean, it was the topic. And the topic was, people are focused in on us at Fox News. Is this really the only place it's ever happened? Are we broken? Did women stay silent for so long that in some way it's our fault? Like, we had difficult conversations as a team of women, and we would have them in the bathroom. We would have them in our office. We would have them in the hallway. And then things started to come apart in other places.
From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook. That's Harris Faulkner, the journalist and newscaster who hosts Outnumbered and Outnumbered Overtime on the Fox News Channel. That makes her the only woman of color on any of the three major cable news channels with her own weekday TV show.
I don't think about it in moment to moment as I do my job. Like, I'm not thinking about covering that White House story or whatever the news is from the perspective of a Black woman at all times. That would be odd. I don't shop that way. You know, like, oh, these shoes are lovely, but as a Black woman, I don't think I should wear them. But there are certain things where the topic comes up.
We talked about how she grew up as a military brat with a father who would record audio cassettes and mail them home to her, how Fox News has changed since the Me Too movement began, and what frustrates her about politics in 2020.
It's part of what kind of frustrates me right now with where we are and social media and fake news and all of that. I find I am hungrier than ever to just get to the truth. And I run out of patience sometimes when I think I'm not getting it.
And now, here's my conversation with Harris Faulkner. So we are in Fox headquarters here. There are three big cable news channels, Fox, obviously, CNN, MSNBC. And across those three, there's only one woman of color who hosts her own weekday TV show. That is you. How significant was that, or do you think that is?
Well, you know, at the time, it felt big because I was the first in primetime, and I had done that for 6 years with Fox Report on the weekends at 7 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday nights. And so to segue to weekdays and to have a single presence in that seat felt particularly significant to me as a journalist. But personally, Anna, I think it was also important because my girls are in elementary and now even junior high, and they were going to get to see mom. Mm-hmm. You know, and they were going to get to see her do something that was maybe not record-breaking, because I'm not the first, but groundbreaking. And certainly that has lasted, is no other network, as you've pointed out, news network on cable, has met us where we are with that female in a solo chair as an African-American woman. So it's been a big deal to me. And then just wider for the industry, it's a wake-up call and a reminder of what people need to do if they want to keep up with Fox.
You have such a prominent position where all eyes are on you. And I'm wondering, do you ever feel this additional pressure as the only woman of color?
You know, I don't think about it in moment to moment as I do my job. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not thinking about covering that White House story or covering, you know, that protest wherever it may be or a plant closing or whatever the news is from the perspective of a Black woman at all times.
Right.
That would be odd. I don't shop that way. You know, like, oh, these shoes are lovely, but as a Black woman, I don't think I should wear them. But there are certain things where the topic comes up. I think from the perspective of covering stories where being a minority is part of the story, it matters when a Black church is hit in South Carolina by someone with hate in their spirit. That's something that touches all of America. But as a person of color, I see that story even through a deeper prism of, gosh, that takes us back to a time when Black churches were targets in this country, so on and so forth. But I always hearken back to something my dad said. He served this country, was a war pilot twice in Vietnam. He, at one point, as we do in our lives, had a choice of how he would feel about America. He said, we didn't have it perfect in the 60s and early 70s, but what we have that no other nation on earth has is the kind of potential that feels anointed, that feels meant for us. And with that comes this incredible expectation of what we can do around the world and what we can do with each other. And he loves America, loved it then, and would have fought no matter what, even at a time when there were signs up that relegated him to a different water fountain or a different bathroom. So I was raised with that spirit, and I totally believe that our potential outweighs and goes beyond anything in race and diversity that we could ever fight about or disagree about. So I approach the news with that hopefulness at all times.
Well, you make my job easy. We're going to take a step back and go back in time a little bit. Where did you grow up?
On military bases, all over. I was born at Fort McPherson in Atlanta, Georgia. My dad had just graduated from flight school, aeronautical engineering at Georgia Tech. And that was a big thing in the 60s to be Black and do that. So we were stationed in Stuttgart, Germany, while my dad was dispatched in other places. And then eventually on to the Vietnam War. And so we lived in Stuttgart, Ludwigsburg, where the barracks, where my dad's fighter plane was also housed in Germany, until I was about in kindergarten or so. Then Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where he held a battalion. We did two tours there, as they call it on base. So kind of all over.
We talked about kind of moving around a lot. There was often times when your father was not physically able to be with you and he would be separated.
A lot growing up.
And I read that he would record messages for you.
Yeah. He would make, well, I don't even know if the young kids know what a cassette tape is.
We'll bring them back.
Heck fire. How does that work? Well, boys and girls, you take this plastic thing that if you leave it in the sun, you're dust. So you have to protect it. It's about the size of a good slice of cinnamon bread. And you stick that into the old cassette player. And they had these things all over the planet at the time. And Dad had them in the field at war. And every now and then it would take a month to get things from that part of the world when he was fighting. But he did the 12 Days of Christmas. He would talk to me. I was a little one, just a toddler. And he didn't want me to forget that storytelling is so important to us. That sounds so cliche now that I'm a journalist. I shouldn't even say that out loud anymore.
No, it's very
just
sweet.
Like, oh, you know, but it's true. I mean, I do what I do because I come from a guy who literally sounds like he could be a broadcaster. Like he made Walter Cronkite just sound wimpy. Like that voice was amazing. And the way he would tell 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, I mean, it would have you hang. Well, so what happens? Like you didn't know,
right.
You know? And so my mom would play these over and over. And the first time he came home, we didn't see him a lot, but the first time he came home from a lengthy deployment, and I think I was 2. And my mom said that when he would speak, I would freeze, you know, and I hadn't been walking that long. I was a late walker, but he would speak. And I just, that voice, because that's the only way I really knew him. You know, we didn't have cell phones, so it's not like he could send us a selfie. Can you imagine that?
No.
What's that even like?
And even just like a month, it took a month to, you know, get it to you. I mean, that's just kind of how time has sped up so much in so many areas of our lives. You talk a lot in your book, talks a lot about the lessons you took from his example. I'm curious about your mom. Can you tell us about her influence on you?
I love that question. It's fun to talk about her because in many instances, that's where the discipline came from. Because when you're not home as much at a young age, you don't want to have that. You want
to be
like,
unicorns
and rainbows, you know, and my mother was in the kitchen going, I'm going to chase that unicorn down, you know. But yeah, I mean, my mother taught me sensibility and to balance what you have going on in your life at all times with what's expected of you. And Dad was a lieutenant colonel, and she and my dad were leaders on military base, you know, the officers' wives, so on and so forth. The connection that she wanted me to have with kids off base, let them know what it's like to serve. Let them know what it's like to, because I didn't always go to school on base. As I got older, you know, you do high school off base. And my mother taught me to remember that your connection with people is based on what you're allowing them to touch about you, which was the opposite of what you get as a military kid, because dad's in a uniform. He's official. He's, you don't poke that. But with mom, you do. Always question authority. And now, I mean, my job is to talk to generals. How cool is that?
Now you get to question them, actually.
Right? But I'm practiced at it because my mom said, the facts matter. And right now, your dad's off, serving, leading wherever he was at that point as I got older. And he's fighting on behalf of a country that believes in getting it right and justice. It's part of what kind of frustrates me right now with where we are and social media and fake news and all of that. I find I am hungrier than ever to just get to the truth. And I run out of patience sometimes when I think I'm not getting it. My mother did give me a sunny disposition, so I can run out of patience without cussing people out. So that's good, right?
keeps you in, yeah. in your position, probably.
Right? Keep it fun. But I do find that I have a certain perspective and intolerance for people who try to twist and bend whatever the truth might be. So I think I'm right in the right time. We hope in life that we have relevance with what our dreams are. And so I'm thankful that I feel like I'm right for the moment because I have the patience to listen, but I'm hungry enough to just keep asking the questions.
Well, let's talk about that. So you have a big career, obviously, now at Fox, but rewind a little bit for us. How did you break into journalism?
Well, local news was really important because I think one thing that local news gives you is the ability to handle all sorts of topics. But starting out there in my career, I think was really salient to what I do today. When I first got out of college, I did an internship at KCOP in Los Angeles. And I was really bad at making coffee and some of the duties that I had for the news director. So he tasked me with other stuff. And I would answer the phones in the newsroom. And that was good for me because sometimes I would take calls that were coming in that were tips. It was great. So I have a good background for being able to handle a lot of things at once with just the expectation of, as an intern, well, she's not being paid, but she's perky and she's accurate. And then early in my career, starting out at WNCT-TV, Channel 9, a CBS affiliate in Greenville, North Carolina, a tiny little market, the expectation was you're making $9,900 a year. Your parents are going to have to help you, but you're great at what you do.
Yeah.
Right? And if you just say stuff right, try not to be wrong too often, we'll put you on the news. And I got a couple of breaks along the way. I was there for a little bit more than a year.
I want to talk a little bit about tradecraft. A lot of our conversation at Women Rule, we talk a lot about kind of how do you become leadership? How do you become confident? One of the things I get asked a lot about, and I think a lot about, is kind of the public persona versus the private persona, right? I mean, you are an on-air personality. You're doing events. I think a lot of people would consider that when I do a lot of this kind of similar stuff, that you must be this big extrovert, right? And I'm not really, right? I'm on the weekends. I want to just kind of—
Really?
Oh, no. I want to, hang out. I need some decompression time, read some books.
I don't get that vibe from you, Anna.
But is the on-air persona different than when you're at home with your girls, or is it kind of all the same?
It's all the same. I've been on TV for a quarter century.
Right.
Like most of my adult life. And I learned early on in my career that it doesn't serve me well to try to be, Ron Burgundy on TV. The anchor all buttoned up, and because you slip. And I tend to slip when I see someplace that I've been have a disaster. I've covered things. The Oklahoma City bombing was really the first place that I saw death up close. And we traveled there just 4 hours after that bombing because of the proximity of Kansas City and Oklahoma City and the people that we would have had in common in terms of treating it almost like two commuter. We had a lot of the medical community who worked in both cities. And I think in those moments, what comes forth is you're talking with people who, like one grandmother, I'll never forget it. She lost her grandkids in the daycare that was on the first floor of the Alfred P. Murrow Federal Building. And she said she had fights with God over that. And I think it's impossible to be up close with people and to ask them to let you in if you're fake.
How you kind of mentioned earlier about fake news and the kind of vitriol of the environment that we are in right now.
Yeah.
Certainly unlike anything I've experienced in 15 plus years of doing kind of this journalism. On TV, though, it's different, where you almost have to real-time fact-check people at times.
Yeah.
Has that changed? Have you noticed that you're kind of – how do you handle that responsibility? When to do it, when to not?
So people have always lied. So the fact-checking has always been there. What kind of complicates it now and puts a layer in there that can be challenging moment to moment is social media. Because people think they know things from what they see in social media. So sometimes you have to see what they think they know and debunk it before you can go on. Because people come on television and say all sorts of things that they think they know. Well, I saw up on Twitter and I'm like, oh, okay. And you can't always do it real time. Like, I have a team that's in the control room and they're listening and watching. And we have a fabulous brain room here. Which one of my team members, Jennifer, I'll text her live on the air. Sometimes she'll see me texting and I'm actually asking people questions. Like, especially, you know, on Outnumbered, the talk show, you'll say, what is she doing? And I'm able to multitask. I've got a tablet, two phones. Because in those moments, especially on unscripted shows, you can give a little leeway for making mistakes, but you can't make them every 2 seconds because you let somebody off the hook on mm-hmm. something at all times. The other thing that I think has come into play that we never had before was this mean-spiritedness. I mean, people are just, they've lost their ability to see the humor in themselves. Because if you didn't lose that, you would see how absolutely stupid it is to be mean. Because that's coming back. It's coming back. And my mother was so right about this. When it comes back around, it's attached to all sorts of things, that karma. And she was a woman of faith. She thought it would be, you know, burn you to the ground type stuff. Like, just tell the truth and be civil. And sometimes you win in those instances where you can't, like, what did that person just say? I'm not quite sure if I heard it. That happens a lot, too, because you've got an earpiece in.
Sure, you got a lot of things
And you're trying
happening.
To, like, and so mistakes get made or you didn't quite catch it or whatever. But sometimes what can help you out is, I didn't catch every word of that. This sounded not right to me. I had to do that recently with somebody who had spit out the name of the whistleblower in the impeachment process and at the same time taken down anybody who might be non-binary. I'm gonna just pick the one I think I heard because I didn't hear the other one clearly. Yeah, we're not going to play the be mean based on pronoun game here. Like, I don't know where you're going with that. So you call it when you can see it and when you can hear it, and you're not going to catch everything. But I think you are helped in the audience's eyes by trying.
Because I also think you have a distinct ability to kind of de-escalate some things when things are getting pretty hot. And as you say, maybe more mean-spirited or, you know, what's the secret sauce to that?
Ooh. First of all, I love that you think that I cook with secret sauce. I try to always remember that the show that we're doing is not about us. And I've had to, in a commercial break, look across the couch on Outnumbered and say, I don't care what you guys do when you get up from this couch, but the audience wonders whether or not we can have a real conversation because you look like you're going to hit each other. And a cat fight is really not necessary. And sometimes that cat fight, I mean, I know people are thinking right now, women, but no. I mean, cats fight, doesn't matter what gender they are. And there's a guy in the middle, and sometimes it can get kind of, you know, chippy. And so every now and then I just, on air, and I'll take it as a compliment that you said de-escalate, because I try, so thank you. I try to say, you know, what if one of you is wrong? And what if the goal isn't to see who's right, but what's right? Don't you want to get to that? And what if you both are right about something? You're going to need each other. I mean, I've said that on the air. I think it's important to remember that. And I'm raising a 10 and a 13-year-old. And when they argue, I think to myself, I have to teach them to resolve this so it doesn't get cray cray. And I walk that out on TV because at the end of the day, we really are in it together.
I want to shift a little bit. Throughout the news media, there's been a reckoning on the Me Too movement over the last several years. Almost all networks have been hit by it. Lots of newspapers, lots of Hollywood has obviously been hit by it. When the news of Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly kind of first hit, I know you've talked a lot about this, but and I don't want to belabor it, but what was your reaction? How did you handle it?
Well, those two instances were time apart. The news broke with Roger Ailes first. By the time the news broke with Bill O'Reilly, and it had progressed to the point where women in the building were talking about it daily. I mean, it was the topic. And the topic was, people are focused in on us at Fox News. Is this really the only place it's ever happened? Are we broken? Did women stay silent for so long that in some way it's our fault? Like we had difficult conversations as a team of women, and we would have them in the bathroom. We would have them in our office. We would have them in the hallway. And then things started to come apart in other places. When I started seeing it unravel on Capitol Hill and women coming forward from staff to whomever and telling these, I said, this is big. We have a role in history. And I know that it's not one that any one of us would ever choose. But I made a determination as things were kind of unfolding that, yes, this was leadership in our building. Roger Ailes, the most powerful man in news. But what he did was wrong. And it happened first, but it had been happening. And when you look at the calendar of how long these women at other networks and Hollywood, and I mean, Harvey Weinstein, I don't even have a word. Now, fast forward, I do struggle with how do we take this into the next generation of protecting our daughters and our female coworkers who are young and coming up, and that those next conversations about hashtag Me Too, talking about believing one another and investigating and making sure that the facts come out and holding people accountable and firing those who deserve it. And can we go deeper than that? Were laws broken? As we do all of that, can we simultaneously make sure that women don't become a secondary target again? Like, well, I guess we just better not hire women because they can be trouble. And then corporately, what's it like when a woman is hired? Do you see her as competition? Now, see, this is where I think it is an advantage to be a person of color because we have to look at it as the more opportunity there is for everybody, the better it is all around. I mean, there just simply have to be more seats to put us in them. That historically and categorically has been true. I'm part of what's changing that, I hope. But it's important to keep the conversation about opportunity right now, because we've dealt with the discrimination, I think, and we're still having women come forward, I'm sure, in every corner of society and speak up. So, I mean, we know we're still dealing with things, but I do think that that conversation is the beginning of accountability. Now we have to make sure that we keep women in jobs and keep the opportunities open for them so that they can rise and hire other women, and that the conversation becomes less about you did somebody a favor by giving her a job and more about, wow, she's terrific, merits of the job.
Do you think, I mean, has the culture changed here? Have you seen it, you know, in terms of kind of out of this movement that now, I know you're involved in some of that yourself here at Fox.
You're talking about inclusion.
Yes.
And diversity. And diversity has a lot of levels, gender, so on and so mm-hmm. forth. So I love this question because I sort of treat it the way people ask me in my personal life about balance. How do you keep it all balanced? Have things changed?
Notice we have not asked that question here because right. I don't believe in balance.
Right. Well, and so what I say is every day in my personal life, I try to figure out how to do better and go forward. So here at Fox, it's changing constantly. It's a journey. Am I going to tell you that we flipped on the lights on a Tuesday and, oh my gosh, hashtag me too solved.
Right.
It doesn't work like that. And you hope that it doesn't work like that because that doesn't leave room for people to still come forth. People share their stories at different times. Maybe they're married. We're talking about sexual discrimination. Not everybody wants to have that conversation openly.
Sure.
Maybe some of those people were on the air. We don't know. But the story is only benefited by every voice. And so I think we are definitely going in the right direction. And I'm thrilled that leadership here at Fox are open to having conversations and not treating this like we put it in a box, we closed it, we're ready to move on. The inclusion part of our journey here is ever ending, never ending, everlast. It just goes on. The conversation nationally is changing. And so what we want to make sure is not that we keep up, but that we lead.
So project, we're almost out of time here, but project a little bit. In the next year, we're obviously going to be presidential. Things are going to get more interesting and crazy before everything's settled. What should we be watching from your show, from you? What are you hoping the next year brings?
Okay, you're going to find this hard to believe. I'm going to put into play the same letters of listen. I'm going to be silent. I want to hear from the voters. I just want to hear what people, what's important to them. I like a poll. It can be interesting. I think people sometimes don't tell the truth in polling.
Yeah.
Well, we certainly know that because when people were asked about, are you going to vote for Donald Trump?
Sure.
A heck of a lot of them did. And they said they didn't or didn't say anything at all. So I want to hear what's important. I want to know why President Trump and Bernie Sanders resonate with their bases. Like, what's going on? Those are completely oppositional, but they kind of have the same energy when you go to their rallies that it's this, we love this candidate and blah, 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 blah. A love and an energy that you don't see with every candidate out there.
All right, we're going to end on a lighter note. SNL had a skit a couple of years back where Leslie Jones played you. I've got to ask.
No, I haven't met her, but I do like her.
What is it like to find yourself impersonated on SNL?
All right. So it's happened twice. And the first time, it was just like an out-of-body experience. I was at a gymnastics meet for my now 10-year-old, and I think she was 8 at the time. This past season that it happened, it was premiere opening night, and it was the day after that Friday, Kavanaugh, when Republicans and Democrats decided that they were going to do an FBI investigation. Mm-hmm. I turn on the TV the next day and, you know, I'm watching whatever on that Saturday, that night. My husband's like, I'm going to watch the open of SNL. And I'm like, I'm going to bed. Harris, you might want to get down here. She had my nail polish color. She had my hair, my makeup. I was like, who dat? Fast forward to about 3 months ago. And a fill-in makeup artist here at Fox News leaned in. She said, oh, I'm feeling, it's so nice to meet you. My name is blah, blah, blah. I did the makeup for Leslie Jones.
Oh, my God.
And I'm here and I'm like, get the heck out. Tell me about that eyeliner. And how was it? How was it to do my lashes? Was it hard? Girl, yes. Almost broke an elbow. So it was fun.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Anna.
Women Rule is produced by Zach Stanton. Irina Gucci is the executive producer of Politico Audio. A special thanks to Bob Ald for his help recording in New York. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @apalmerdc. You can also join the Women Rule community by texting WOMEN to 66866.